From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, a look at the stolen generation of Aboriginal people in Australia. We'll speak with two women taken from their families at an early age to be raised as white. Also, a look inside the Olympic industry. But first, where is the money coming from funding the opposition in Yugoslavia? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Newsday is reporting today that former Haitian dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier says he wants to end his exile in France and return to power in the troubled Caribbean country he left 14 years ago. "I am working to get back to Haiti," he said, speaking in French during a telephone interview with Newsday reporter Ron Howell, the first time he has spoken to an American journalist. "That is my goal." The campaign to make Duvalier the next leader of Haiti is being managed by a band of Haitian emigrants using a Crown Heights, Brooklyn section of Brooklyn office as their campaign headquarters. Their campaign has been picking up steam as they worry about Jean-Bertrand Aristide and the possibility of his returning to power. This news from Peru. Military leaders publicly backed President Alberto Fujimori, dampening speculation that the armed forces might move to oust him. They said they respected the president's authority and decision to dismantle the intelligence service, whose chief was recently shown on videotape, apparently offering a bribe to an opposition Congress member. British police have found part of a grenade launcher in a park near the country's spy headquarters, which was hit last night by some type of explosive missile. No one was hurt in the blast on the eighth floor of the Britain's MI6 intelligence service building, and damage was limited to one window and two wall panels. Police don't know yet whether the rocket-propelled grenade was fired from the park where the launcher component was found. The head of Scotland Yard's anti-terrorist branch says the missile may have been fired from a range of 200 to 500 yards. Police said earlier the attackers may have used a type of rocket launcher readily available to the Irish Republican Army. A federal report released yesterday finds U.S. laws meet the requirements of an international treaty on eliminating racism, but that American society itself has not achieved that goal. Among the reasons racism endures, according to the report, persistent attitudes of individual Americans that are steeped in, quote, a legacy of segregation, ignorance, stereotyping, discrimination towards minorities. And systematically, the report names rollbacks in affirmative action, unequal educational opportunities due to racial segregation, police brutality, racial profiling, and, quote, startling high incarceration rates that affect minorities disproportionately. Thousands of Thai women suffered debt bondage and slavery-like conditions in Japan, where they're trafficked into the country's sex industry. This according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. The report charges that Japanese officials, while aware of the dimensions of the problem, have failed to take strong action to curb the trafficking. And it's almost 2 months since the U.S. resumed the bombing of the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Today, as calls for the U.S. to get out of Vieques continue, people from around the U.S. and from Vieques are gathering in Washington, D.C. for the National Day of Solidarity with the people of Vieques. We're joined right now by Andres Tomas Conteres, who is a member of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. He spent 5 days and nights on the Vieques bombing range in May 2000 and is in his 40th day of a hunger fast. He's in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Andres.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you very much.
Can you describe where you are now?
Right now, I'm just a short distance from the White House, where I've been going every weekday to vigil for the past, 60 days. For the past 2 months, I have been there at the White House in order to witness to President Clinton that this policy of his through the U.S. Navy bombing Vieques cannot continue, and that the people there have overwhelmingly expressed that to him, as well as so many thousands of leaders and other people of faith and conscience here in the United States and around the world.
Are you in a wheelchair?
At this time, right now I'm not. I'm just sitting down in a chair. I am able to walk still, Amy. I have enough strength for that, but it's not preferable for me, and I do use a wheelchair because that is more convenient for me to get around that way. And when I do do the vigil itself, I sit in a wheelchair because it's easiest to transport me both there and back that way, as well as to sit in that chair.
How long do you plan to fast?
We have one very specific demand of President Clinton, and it's very simple to comply with. We are requesting that the president simply hold a meeting. And the meeting is one that has been long requested by...
We just have 10 seconds.
Yes, community leaders and religious leaders in Vieques. And when Clinton grants that meeting, then I will stop fasting.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Andres Tomas Canteras, in the 40th day of his fast, protesting in front of the White House with many others today, calling for an end to the bombing of Vieques. We will keep in touch. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The first federal elections in Yugoslavia since NATO's 78-day bombing are down to the wire. On Sunday, voters will head to the polls to decide whether to oust President Slobodan Milosevic and replace him with the opposition candidate Vojislav Kostunica. Milosevic has increased his attacks on the opposition as being what he calls NATO colonizers. His government received fresh ammunition this week for those attacks as reports surface in the press that the U.S. government has been funneling millions of dollars to groups supporting the opposition. In all, the U.S. is slated to give some $77 million to these groups over the next 3 years. What's particularly interesting about this is that this is the very thing that very nearly brought down President Clinton, the issue of foreign money in American politics. It's an issue that has also been plaguing Vice President Al Gore during his campaign with serious questions about his Buddhist temple fundraising scandal. Well, Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill is in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. We turn now to an in-depth report he's filed looking at the U.S. government money pipeline to groups opposing Milosevic, as well as plans by the democratic opposition of Serbia to increase their dealings with the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank should they emerge victorious this weekend. Here is Jeremy's report.
The flow of foreign money into Yugoslavia to groups opposed to President Slobodan Milosevic is no secret here in Belgrade. International financier George Soros and his Fund for an Open Society have filtered hundreds of thousands of dollars to NGOs here for years. Everyone from the opposition radio station B92 and other media outlets to human rights groups to polling outfits have been getting a piece of the action for some time. But now is no ordinary time in Yugoslavia, and the money in question is no small change. And it is not from an NGO, it's from a foreign government, a government that led the bombing of Yugoslavia. With the elections 2 days away, Milosevic's ruling coalition is intensifying its attacks on the opposition as being NATO servants. This week, for the first time in this campaign, Slobodan Milosevic himself blasted the opposition.
Terorističkih grupa i narkomafije za manipulaciju decom i omladinom u sferi praznoverja, paranauke, kiča i falsifikata.
He said they were inspired by the West to spread terrorism and crime, to destroy families through religious sects, spy groups, and narco-mafias. Milosevic said those alleged political parties, united or on their own, it makes no difference, are tasked with spreading lies and defeatism, provoking crime and terrorism, inciting chauvinism. They have the loyalty of dogs, he said, to NATO masters who bribe and pay them. The revelations first published in the Washington Post that the U.S. government has been directly giving millions of dollars to groups opposing Milosevic was all over the news here. And for the groups on the receiving end of the money, the exposure sent shockwaves.
Unfortunately, both Serbia and the United States are at the same time in the pre-election period. And I believe that your government, the United States government, has in this particular period its agenda. And I think because of it, some citizens in this country will suffer as well, because there will be political discussions and political struggle in fora which are out of control of the citizens here.
Duška Anastasijević works as an organizer at the Humanitarian Law Center in Belgrade. The center is one of the many NGOs receiving foreign money. She, like many in this community, sees no problem with taking funds from the U.S. government. Do you see this money as interference within the affairs of a sovereign country?
No. I mean, I can't really account for each and every dollar spent for promotion of civil society in Yugoslavia. So this is the question you should ask the administration. At the end of a recipient, I can tell you that the support received not only by the U.S. government but other non-governmental organizations in Western Europe, in my organization, are used for specific projects and are very detailed, elaborated before or prior to applying for a support. And I also believe that in the 21st century, the notion of this completely the crude notion of sovereignty is gone, and that it would be really stretching it, claiming that supporting certain projects or programs in foreign countries equals interference in affairs of a sovereign state.
What is known at this point about the money coming into Yugoslavia is that it has been used to provide equipment such as fax machines, computers, and phones to opposition groups. It's been used to train opposition organizers and to conduct sophisticated voter surveys, some compiled by the same New York firm that conducts polls for President Clinton. These polls have all put the opposition candidate Vojislav Koštunica well ahead of Milosevic. Belgrade political scientist Novak Gajic has studied the pattern of U.S. government funding of groups opposed to Milosevic.
Well, the money comes, the most of the money so far was coming through the United States Agency for International Development, in some cases directly, but in more cases through other foundations and other NGOs. And I could name National Endowment for Democracy, National Democratic Institute, International Republican Institute, and there are some others as well. The money enters the country through Hungary. The transfer of money from the United States to Hungarian banks goes clearly, legally, so to say. And then money enters Serbia. It is carried by the people, usually by the Serbs.
Gajic says the intention of the U.S. is undoubtedly aimed at interfering internally in Yugoslavia, but he questions whether it is truly aimed at toppling Milosevic.
I'm not sure whether that is the aim of the United States government, or is it just convenient to have another Saddam Hussein in Europe. Reasons behind that could be to keep United States troops in Europe in circumstances, in post-Cold War circumstances, where their presence is not that much sustainable to stay in Germany and elsewhere in Western Europe. Now the United States keep tens of thousands of their troops in the Balkans, and they obviously, these troops are obviously going to stay here for years, if not for decades. Slobodan Milosevic and his regime, they're giving the alibi to U.S. Military presence, not only in this region, but in Europe in general.
The elections are heading into the final stretch here in Yugoslavia, and the democratic opposition of Serbia wrapped up its campaign this week with a mass rally in Belgrade. There, opposition candidate Vojislav Koštunica told more than 150,000 people they had a choice between continued isolation from the world and what he called a normal life.
Ja sam vaš deo, običan sam čovjek ovi svi. Nije mi
nada. I'm part of you, he said. I'm an ordinary man like all of you. It's not my intention to rearrange the world. My intention is that together with you, we will rearrange our country.
Znam da vi želite da živite isto kao što ja želim da živim.
I know that you want, as much as I do, to live in an ordinary, normal, democratic, European country. But when the opposition politicians here speak of turning Yugoslavia into what they call a normal, democratic, European country, just what they mean is not always abundantly clear. Yugoslavia was once known as a global force in the fight for a non-aligned movement to combat global domination by the United States in the West and the Soviet Union in the East. Its longtime communist leader, Josip Broz Tito, was known as a bridge between the two poles and was famous for standing up to Soviet ruler Joseph Stalin. Even under the government of Slobodan Milosevic in the post-Cold War world, Yugoslavia has not gone the same route as many former Eastern Bloc countries, where they are now opening their markets to multinational corporations, privatizing state-owned industries, and deregulating their economies. But if the democratic opposition of Serbia takes power here after this weekend's elections, its leaders intend to put Yugoslavia on the fast track in the direction of its Eastern European neighbors. And as was the case with many countries, it will bring increased management from the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Mlađan Dinkić heads up the pro-West economist group G17. He is widely viewed as a strong candidate for Minister of the Economy in the event of an opposition victory.
The new government will have a program of economic reform, and we are sure that this will be acceptable for IMF and the World Bank. We intend to present the letter of intent to IMF by December 15 and hope that we will be again the member of IMF. After that, we expect conversations about the new credits and, of course, solving the problem of old debt we have to IMF and the World Bank. But anyway, I think that if we have good people who are capable to implement economic program, IMF and World Bank cannot make any damage to this implementation. If the problem is in the countries where people are not so well educated and they cannot implement some programs, and the problem is if IMF and the World Bank make program for those countries. So we made the program ourselves. We have in our group, in G17, we have a few people who are in fact employed in the World Bank and IMF and in some other financial institution in Europe.
Dinkić and other economists working with the opposition speak with an undeniable excitement when asked about the prospect of foreign loans coming to Yugoslavia. And even though the opposition is by no means guaranteed to take power after Sunday's elections, the monetary commitments are pouring in. The European Union has promised to release a substantial amount of aid for the country if the DOS emerges victorious. The Norwegian government last week said it would give Yugoslavia $15 million if Milosevic is ousted. The United States would also be expected to aid the new government. Another carrot dangled in front of the opposition is the EU foreign minister's announcement this week they would lift sanctions against the country in return for a change of leadership. But away from the excitement of the economists surrounding him,
Vojislav Koshtunitsa speaks in more modest tones. The opposition presidential candidate says he is aware of the risks involved with dealing with international lending agencies.
When I'm speaking about that, I always have in mind the very difficult social situation in the country and the necessity to support and follow all these programs, including privatization and so on, with different sorts of social programs. However, we are a poor country this moment. We must take care of the socially most, the people that are in a socially most dangerous position and care about the poverty, about old, young, ill, and so on and so on.
As tens of thousands of people from across Europe prepare to descend on Prague to protest the IMF and the World Bank, Yugoslavia could be beginning its journey toward the very system at the center of the protests. And though the eyes of Milosevic's opponents are focused in on ousting him, there are those who fear the fate of other Eastern Bloc countries where workers earn Eastern European salaries and face Western European prices, where public health care and free education are quickly becoming things of the past, where the most vulnerable in these countries face increasingly bleak realities. Political scientist Novak Gajic.
And yes, I'm pretty much aware that this is going to have terrible consequences compared to not only to Central and Eastern Europe, but also compared to what was happening in other parts of the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia, in what we call the Third World, what was happening there over decades. Central and Eastern Europe are now becoming part of the Third World.
The Milosevic government says these elections are about a continuation of the policy of the last 10 years. In his campaign stops, the president plays heavily on the theme that the country is rebuilding and unifying with other countries in a struggle against Western imperialism. The opposition says it represents everything the current government does not. To win the elections this weekend, the candidates must win a simple majority of the votes cast. If not, there will be a second-round runoff between the two leading candidates. So Sunday may just be the first battle in a war that will determine what direction the country will head in at the beginning of the 21st century. For Democracy Now!, this is Jeremy Scahill in Belgrade, Yugoslavia.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As thousands flock to the Sydney Athletic Stadium to see Aboriginal sprinter Kathy Freeman in her first race of the 2000 Olympics today, Aboriginal people from around Australia are looking to Kathy as a symbol of a better tomorrow. Kathy Freeman recently told a British newspaper that her own grandmother was one of the many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children who was removed from her biological parents simply because she was Indigenous. The removed children are known as the Stolen Generation. And a recent report completed by the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Commission found that as many as 200,000 Indigenous children were taken from their families. About 5 years ago, a national inquiry was launched in Australia into the separation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children from their families. It was largely a response to efforts by key Indigenous agencies and communities that were concerned that the general public's ignorance of history was hindering the recognition of the needs of its victims and their families. Today, people are calling the systematic removal of Indigenous children a crime. We're joined by two members of the Stolen Generation. Nancy DeVries is an Aboriginal retired nurse, now helping to raise her 7 grandchildren, removed from her mother when she was 1 year old. And Lola Edwards also joins us from Sydney. She's a policy officer at the Aboriginal Medical Research Council of New South Wales, removed at the age of 4 with her brothers and sisters. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. First, did Kathy Freeman run today? Lola Edwards.
Yes, she did. Yes.
Did she win?
Yes.
Yes, she, it's the preliminary heats.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and she won her section, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what was the response?
Oh, you poor. Well, you could have heard it in New York, I suppose. Yes, it was wonderful.
Well, I know in the Commonwealth Games in 1994, when she ran her victory lap, to say the least, it was very controversial because instead of wrapping herself in the Australian flag, she wrapped herself in the Aboriginal flag. Lola Edwards, the latest from Kathy Freeman was that her grandmother was a member of the Stolen Generation. Can you tell us about your own experience?
Yeah, sure. I was removed from my family at the age of 4 years old, and I was removed with my younger sister and brother and older sister, and we were removed and placed into government institutions. And we were separated at the main central railway station in Sydney from our brother. And we were separated there and put on a train to the institution, which was called the Cootamundra Aboriginal Girls Training Home. And my brother was put into a home similar but for our brothers.
Who took you away from your home?
The it was under government policy. It was government welfare officers.
What year was it?
1951.
And what was the reason given?
There was no court committals or anything. It was simply taken because I was Aboriginal and also because, according to them, I was a neglected child, quote unquote.
Nancy DeVries,
yes.
What year were you taken from your family?
In 1933.
1933. And
yes.
Who came and got you?
I don't know. I was just a baby, but I do know that I was removed from my mum and I was placed into the system of welfare, you know, in the children's home at Clovelly in New South Wales in Sydney, and then later on to different foster parents and orphanages and mission stations all through my life. 22 different places, in fact, in my 18, before I turned the age of 18.
And they were all, you were put into families, were they all white families?
Yes, yes. I was taught that Aboriginal people were no good and that they were bad and they were dirty and they were drunks. And that I shouldn't have any contact with them and always told and brought up to feel that I was not worthy because I was Aboriginal. Lola, and I thank God that I was able to identify as an Aboriginal person all my life.
Lola Edwards, did you know you were Aboriginal?
Oh, yes. It's the other thing is it's unmistakable. I have dark skin, a lot darker than Kathy Freeman. But aside from that, I was being raised, funny enough, to be a white person, to be a white human being, as was my sisters. We were constantly told that, similar to Nancy, that our people didn't want us and that we should forget about where we came from. And one of the reasons that we were put into the homes was because of that very fact that our people didn't want us. But, of course, I was to find out years ago that that was untrue, as our family never stopped trying to get us back.
When did you reunite with your family?
1980.
How old were you?
28, 29.
How did you find your mother?
How did I find? Well, my younger sister, who was taken with us, she started an organization in New South Wales called Link Up, and it reunites Aboriginal, the organization attempts to reunite Aboriginal adults who were separated and stolen from their families. And I was living in America at the time. I was living in Honolulu. And she asked me if I would like to meet my mother. I never thought about it at the time, really, as I do now. But I always thought that one day I would see her. And that's how it came about, was through my younger sister that I met my mother and also other members of my family.
What was it like to meet your mother for the first time in your 20s since you were 4 years old?
Yeah, it was that I looked at this little lady and I thought, well, yes, she is my mother, but there were too many years had gone by that you cannot even know how I felt. Nobody can, because simply because I was looking at a little human being and a beautiful little lovely person that she was, and I thought, this little lady is my mum. This lady who gave birth to me. But beyond that, as far as feelings, I had no idea at the time what a mother was like. Because I had never had a mother. So the only any closeness that anyone ever came to, like a mother, as everyone human being who was born experiences, was the matron in the home, and she was a white woman. So for many years, she was like a surrogate mother to me, that white woman. But of course, for a time she was, but not throughout my formative years. But when I first saw my natural mother, it was something, of course, I can never forget.
Nancy DeVries, what about your story? When you were taken, you were one. How old were you when you re-met your mother? 53 years old?
Yes.
And how did you find her?
Like, Lola, you look at this person in front of you and you realise that this person was your mother. For the first time in my life, I was looking at somebody that I could see I was like. I looked like her. But for 53 years, my mother had lived with this, and she could not sort of... She denied me as her baby. That woman, that old woman, and I was an old woman, that old woman is not my baby. that, again, is another form of rejection, but I do not blame her. I thank God I was able to meet her and see her and meet her, and I've also met other members of my family. After a year, after a lifetime of not having anybody to be surrounded by, quite a large family, is pretty wonderful. But of course, half deny you and half of the family accept you. It's still very traumatic at times.
Kathy Freeman has called for, and she's certainly not the only person in Australia calling on the government to be apologizing. What has been the Prime Minister's response, Nancy DeVries?
Well,
as loud as you can speak.
Pardon?
Speak as loud as you can.
Okay. Well, he is in denial, as a lot of Australians are in this country, that what they did to myself and my people never happened. And until he comes to terms with that, I'm afraid that this country will never be at rest. The soul of this country will never be at rest until that happens. I doubt very much if he will. I'm pretty sure of it now. That he will never make the formal government apologies from the federal government that was hoped for in the recommendations of the Bringing Them Home report, which it is now called the report of the inquiry. But that it is, how can I say, the Aboriginal way, out of respect and dignity, to apologise for wrongs that you may have done to a people.
Now, Lola Edward, just understand.
This never happened.
200,000 Indigenous children, it is believed, were taken from their families. Is the government acknowledging that that happened?
They have acknowledged part. Each state government has apologized except for the Northern Territory and Queensland, I believe, Nancy.
No, they haven't yet.
Just the Northern Territory and
yes,
the federal government.
Yes, that's right.
And if they don't, if they're unable to do that, what they are trying to do now, why do they have to now try to dispute what happened, although they have half-heartedly said, yes, it did happen, but they're really looking at the issue of monetary compensation payout to members of that, the stolen generation and their descendants, as being too much for Australians to bear, which comes, the Australian government to bear, which is why he will not make a formal apology from the Australian government. It has now, I suppose, come to light that this government will never apologise to the Indigenous people of this country.
I think it's a fear tactic by our beloved Prime Minister.
A fear tactic?
Yes. I think he's trying to put fear into the Aboriginal people to make them think, you know, that we are going to sue him for billions and billions of dollars, the government for billions. No amount of money could repay me for the loss of my beautiful, beautiful mother and her suffering all those years. And I'm sure that I'm speaking for Lola as well, that, you know, why use these tactics of trying to frighten the Australian public about what a simple word like sorry would mean? If you can follow my reasoning, it is such a simple word. We Aboriginal people are supposed to be part of the Australian family. you know, if a member of your family is hurt or has been hurt, you say a simple, I'm sorry that happened, let's see it doesn't happen again. But he finds great difficulty in saying this to us.
Well, we hope to continue this discussion with the two of you next week, the issue of Aboriginal rights and the experience that you've had in Australia. Is being highlighted now because of the Olympics and because of the woman who lit the Olympic cauldron, Kathy Freeman. She's going to be running on Sunday and Monday. But it's certainly not a new issue for you or for Australians in general, and a lot of similar experiences of Indigenous people around the world. I want to thank you both for being with us this week. Again, we will continue the interview next week as the Olympics continue. Our guests have been Nancy DeVries, an Aboriginal retired nurse now helping to raise her own 7 grandchildren. She herself taken away from her family when she was 1. Lola Edwards with the Aboriginal Medical Research Council of New South Wales, removed from her family with her brothers and sister when she was 4 years old, all members of the Stolen Generation. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to talk about the Olympic industry, the story behind the games. We're going to talk about the hard business, the cold cash. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. 1 week into the 2000 Olympic Games in Sydney, Americans are tuning in surprisingly low numbers. Many criticize there's too much soft coverage of the host city, tanned Australian blondes playing volleyball on pristine beaches, beautiful restored harbors, not enough coverage of the games themselves. But the pristine setting on US TV, on NBC, belies some of the ugly realities that have marred Sydney's Olympic role: bribery investigations, a skyrocketing housing market, and displaced residents. The mass media wants to show off the beautiful setting of the Olympics, and for Sydney, there's no greater honor than to host the international goodwill and spirited competition of the Olympics. But what are some of the pre- and post-Olympic impacts on this city that's hosting the games? The grassroots resistance movements, the role of the mass media in the controversy. We're going to go behind the scenes to look at the politics surrounding the choice of Sydney, Australia to host this 2000 Summer Olympics. We're joined on the ISDN line from Canada, Helen Lenski, who is the author of Inside the Olympic Industry, Power, Politics, and Activism. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. So tell us, how was Sydney, Australia chosen? You yourself are Australian, is that right?
Yes, I was born and raised in Sydney. And before we leave the very moving presentation you just had, I would like to say as a white Australian to Nancy and Lola, I'm sorry. That is something that isn't that the as they said, the Prime Minister isn't willing to say. So as somebody who was born and raised in Sydney, and I've had the privilege of going back once a year sometimes twice a year for the last 10 years as part of my research and partly holiday. And so I've kept in touch with what is going on, particularly at the grassroots level around Sydney's Olympic bid and preparations. And I think the bribery and corruption behind all the bids, those topics are fairly well known now to listeners, and there have been exposés. The mainstream press have even been fairly thorough in covering the stories of bribery and corruption, although my only criticism of that is they tend to target individual villains, the individual bad guys, and they're usually men. And there's not so much attention given to this entire system, which I maintain in my book is a corrupt system. And so villains flourish in that system. They thrive in a system that pretty much rewards the wheeling and dealing behind the scenes. And Sydney was no exception.
So explain how it operated.
Well, in the case of Sydney, the head of the Australian Olympic Committee, John Coates, was alleged to have passed some checks for, I think it was $50,000 Australian each, to two of the African IOC members through a third party, through what have been now called an Olympic agent, who was paid to do this kind of intermediary function between particularly IOC members from developing countries and IOC members from the Western world. And
IOC being the International Olympic Committee.
That's right. And it seems as if these agents sort of served as a cultural bridge between the two groups. And in the case of Sydney, the bid won by two votes over Beijing. So Beijing people were not very pleased at this outcome, because the theory being without these two deciding votes, things might have looked quite different. In any event, Sydney was by no means the only offender or the worst offender. As various, the process of bidding in various bid cities, Toronto, which was a losing bid for 1996, Atlanta, a winning bid, Sydney, Stockholm, a number of other countries, a number of other bid groups, rather, it came to light that there had been this kind of misconduct on the part of bid committees and on the part of IOC members. Where there were gift givers, there were also gift receivers, and it worked both ways. So Sydney was certainly not immune to any of that, but that now is sort of ancient history. The theory is that the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has cleaned up its act. It's been reformed. It's squeaky clean now. As I say in my book, they talk about evolution, not revolution, and these very, very slow evolutionary changes, for example, including more athletes in the IOC, adding new members, most of whom are athletes. This is seen as a cure for everything. And I have an extensive discussion in the book of something that I call the myth of the pure Olympic athlete, as though being an Olympic athlete sort of renders you immune to any kind of criticism. You're above reproach. You're pure and wholesome. And if you, an Olympic athlete, are put on the IOC, a retired Olympic athlete, of course, you couldn't be a current one, then this will be a major step towards reform. In fact, about a third of the old IOC membership were retired Olympic athletes or retired Olympic coaches or officials of some kind, and they didn't have a squeaky clean record.
We're talking to Helen Jefferson-Lenski, who's a professor of sociology at the University of Toronto. Her book is Inside the Olympic Industry, Power, Politics, and Activism. In addition, we've got Beth Jewell on the line with us from Sydney, who is the coordinator of Rent Watchers, a campaign to lobby against the enormous rent increases which came from the Olympic Games. Beth Jewell, can you describe how Sydney was transformed and the effect it had on the people there?
It was an amazing sort of Olympic industry that came to town, and our government here said, we're not going to be as bad as Atlanta because we're building a stadium where there's no housing. In Atlanta, the uproar was that they actually evicted people on the stadium site. Here in Sydney, they built the stadium at Homebush, which was actually a toxic waste site where no one could live. But the ramifications were more subtle here, where what happened in Sydney was an accelerated gentrification, huge rent increases across the city and massive evictions, not massive in Atlanta-type style, but certainly ramifications of any mega event that happens in any city. You have increased gentrification, and the people who suffer are the low-income earners, the tenants. In Australia, as opposed to New York, tenants don't have the same tenancy rights as you do in New York, where people can be evicted for no reason. Boarders and lodgers can be tossed out with 2 days' notice, and we saw at least 5,000 people overall being evicted. Rent increases went up to 30 to 40% across the inner city, inner west area. Bondi Beach, where the volleyball is, where you're all watching these blonde beauties popping balls over nets. The people around there actually suffered huge inconvenience, and affordable housing is something that we've lost forever. So the legacy of the Olympic Games is a serious hypocrisy and denial of democratic rights. And I think that any city bidding for the Olympics, and I pity Toronto, who have a worse homeless problem that we have here in Sydney, should be very, very careful when they take on something like a massive industry that only cares about Nike versus Adidas and CBN versus ABC, blah, blah, blah. The people who suffer are the people with no money, and they're not going to benefit from anything like the Olympic Games.
I'm looking at the cover of Helen Lenski's book, Inside the Olympic Industry, and it's marchers holding a banner, No Olympics in Toronto, We Want Bread, Not Circuses. And Helen, that's where you are now, right?
Yes, and Bread Not Circuses is the name of a grassroots coalition of anti-poverty activists, housing activists, environmentalists, union people, university student activists, and so on. And the picture on the cover was taken in 1990 when two of our organization, Jan Borowy and David Kidd, who are on either end of the banner, flew to Tokyo, funded by an anonymous gift donor from Toronto, flew to Tokyo during the IOC session and made a very, very visible protest, partly during the session. They walked through chanting No Olympics in Toronto, We Want Bread, Not Circuses. As you can see on the cover picture, they walked in solidarity with Tokyo groups who were opposed to the Nagano Olympic bid and so on. So there is this loose but very active and connected network of anti-Olympic and Olympic watchdog organizations around the world. And I'm pleased to hear Beth again. Hi, Beth. My group has been very involved with the various groups that Beth belongs to in Sydney.
Can you talk about sustainable sport, what this concept is?
Well, in my chapter on the environment, I talk about the claim that Sydney are the best, or the first probably green games. Lillehammer was considered the first Winter Olympics that could be called an environmentally sustainable Olympic Games, and Sydney now has that distinction. There are lots of critiques of that claim. Greenpeace and Green Games Watch 2000 in Sydney are very sceptical about this being really a Green Games. In fact, Greenpeace took the organisers to court over the claim that they were using the world's best practice in terms of the refrigerants used on the Olympic site. And the ones that they were using were ones that contributed to greenhouse gases and ozone depletion, so there was no way that claim could be valid. It wasn't that Greenpeace thought they could change everything, they just wanted the false advertising to stop, and I think that was settled out of court. In the case of Bondi Beach, which is in the world spotlight right now, as you said, millions of dollars were spent on a temporary Olympic beach volleyball stadium, which will be demolished by the end of October, I think it is. About 30% of the beach was dug up. This was one of the world famous surfing beaches. Bondi is internationally known. It was a threat environmentally to dig up 30% of the beach and put this atrocious looking structure up there. Simply, and the rumor, which I think is well substantiated, is that NBC wanted sort of the visuals that would go with Bondi Beach. It's not enough to have half-naked women playing volleyball, but they wanted the beautiful Pacific Ocean and the beach at Bondi to be in the picture.
Beth Jewell, coordinator of Rent Watchers in Sydney, what happens when the Olympics leaves? Where does it leave you?
Well, we are concerned about the legacy of the Games, and we have a really big stadium, and we're hoping that it's really funny, the politics around who maintains the stadium is actually falls to a local municipality, and the money that's gone into building it, over $2 billion, has been what we call misplaced priorities. But what's happened with the gentrification and the loss of social diversity in the inner city is the most tragic thing in my point of view, because it's created a plastic city that everyone likes to see, clean streets, no homeless people, no punks with green hair, and nobody who can afford to live there besides people jogging to work in Nikes. We find it, the legacy will be that a city has been marred by the Olympic Games yet again. Apparently, even in the 1920s, parts of Paris were ruined by the Olympic Games. But nobody cares about that sort of thing, that they can lose affordable housing and working class areas have gone forever, because once you clear an area of real people and put in wealthy people, they will never come back. And I think that the financial aftermath, as in every other Olympic Games, we can gloss over it here because the public only know about $2 to $3 billion that have been spent, but that's not counting the opening ceremony, it's not counting the drug testing, it's not counting the uniforms, it's not counting any other millions of dollars that we've seen spent for the Olympic Games. And as a city that could spend that on healthcare, welfare and housing for people, not to mention our Indigenous brothers and sisters, I think that it's a crying shame. And the gloss of Olympic Games where drugged up people are running around a rink is really not a good excuse for human rights abuse.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. Beth Jewell, coordinator of Rent Watchers, a campaign to lobby against the rent increases which came with the Olympic Games, speaking to us from Sydney, and Helen Lenski. Her book is called Inside the Olympic Industry, Power, Politics, and Activism. She is a professor at the University of Toronto, and the book is published by SUNY Press in Albany, New York. I want to thank you both for being with us, and that does it for this program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrak Franklin. Special thanks to Dan Coughlin, Jeremy Scahill, and Deepa Fernandez. Matthew Finch is our engineer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!